The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here, we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on, and we thank you for listening. Today we're tackling ovarian cancer with guest expert, Tampa Bay gynecologic oncologist, Dr. Tyler Kirby. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with over 1,000 women during each of our last two events, with a combined 7,500 hours of education on those 2 days, is supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families through the immediate impact of direct with the expert health education. And as indicated earlier, with me today is Dr. Tyler Kirby. Tyler, it's great to have you here today.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And Tyler joined us in our big annual symposium this past March, giving one of the seminars on gynecologic oncology, as that is his area of expertise. And today, of course, we're going to focus on ovarian cancer. And I want to say a few words about Dr. Kirby, who is a graduate of the University of Alabama. And he remained there for his entire medical training, including 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency in obstetrics gynecology, as well as post-residency fellowship training in gynecologic oncology. He is board certified in both the American Board of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, as well as subspecialization in gynecologic oncology. He specializes in minimally invasive surgery and is one of the most experienced robotic cancer surgeons in the nation, having performed well over 400 robotic procedures. He currently serves on the board of directors for the Gynecologic Cancer Foundation. And in addition, I might say, to any question any one of you may have about ovarian cancer, if you are interested in learning more about robotic surgery, this may be a good opportunity, too, to call and ask questions, at least as it pertains to gynecologic oncology, as Dr. Kirby is well-experienced and doing this procedure as well. And once again, to remind each of you, our phone numbers to call in Hillsborough County, 289-1860. That's 289-1860 everywhere else, and especially for those of you that may be streaming online at focusonfemales.com. The out-of-town phone number is area code 877. That's toll-free, 877-969-8600. And so let's talk about ovarian cancer. And actually, before we even do that, let's talk about the training of a gynecologic oncologist. In other words, sometimes general surgeons may do a procedure of identifying, locating abdominal mass, perhaps even a gynecologic malignancy. What is it? How does a gynecologic oncologist differ from, say, a gynecologist or even a general surgeon as far as approaching these potential malignancies?
Well, gynecologic oncologists, we spend an extra 3 years of training after a regular OBGYN residency learning specific surgical techniques to try to remove all of these cancers, and it becomes quite complex. We are a very unique field in that we're able to combine aspects not only of benign gynecology, but also from medical oncology and also general surgery. For example, somebody presents to us with what looks to be a mass that may be suspicious, either referred to us by their regular doctor or their gynecologist. We're able to surgically remove that mass. If that mass does indeed turn out to be malignant and is involving multiple other structures in the body, then we'll take on the general surgery role, removing those other structures. For example, bowel resections, colon resections. We even do our own urology work with bladder resections and ureteral reimplantations and what have you. And then what really makes us unique is that after the surgery, if you have breast cancer, for example, you go to a breast cancer surgeon, they remove your tumor. If you need chemotherapy, they then send you on to someone else. If you need radiation therapy, you're seeing a third person. And so your care tends to be fragmented in some way. With our specialty, we have training so that we do all of that. We do the surgery. The patients stay with us. We manage their chemotherapy. For those patients that are getting radiation therapy, although we don't actually apply the radiation therapy ourselves, we're oftentimes helping the radiation oncologist plan the therapy and even helping them place some of the implants at times as well. So what I tell patients is, you really get sort of, once you're my patient, you're really my patient and for life.
I think there's an excellent point. Many people are not even aware of such a specialty as gynecologic oncology. And I think it's a significant service to share that that's the existence of such a specialty with the public. Furthermore, my understanding, and I imagine you'd confirm that the gynecologic oncologist is the one who's best prepared to stage a particular cancer malignancy because of the ability to identify neighboring structures of involvement of malignancy.
That's correct. Most gynecologists are not trained to do the appropriate staging and really aren't trained to do all of the extensive procedures designed to remove all of this cancer. As a matter of fact, most general surgeons, although they probably technically have the skills to do so, they tend not to do it. There have been studies that look at the number of women that are correctly staged with ovarian cancer when they're operated on by someone like myself versus someone that's either a general surgeon or a general gynecologist, and we're twice as likely to correctly stage them. We're twice as likely to remove all of their cancer. And in the end, their overall survival tends to be about 25% better if they're managed by somebody like me as opposed to some, you know, combination of general surgery and gynecology.
2 points. One is oftentimes a general surgeon, when evaluating an abdominal mass, when they identify it to be malignant, they often refer the patient to a gynecologic oncologist. Correct?
That's correct, yes.
So what we're hearing here is that the gynecologic oncologist is kind of like the hub of the wheel for the patient, say, with ovarian cancer.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And again, we welcome any questions on the roles of different subspecialists in this field that you may have out there. Okay, let's move on to ovarian cancer. How about a very, very brief overview of the anatomy of the female reproductive tract and of ovaries?
Well, the uterus is situated at the top of the vagina. Obviously, that's where babies are grown before they're born. The ovaries are where the eggs are initially formed before the babies, and the fallopian tubes sort of sit right next to the ovary and are a communication tract between the uterus and the abdominal cavity. And they're actually open to the inside of the abdomen. Now,
the fallopian tubes.
The fallopian tubes are, that's correct. Now, the inside of the abdomen, all of the bowels and all of the structures within the abdomen are lined with this type of tissue called the peritoneum. And that actually includes the outer lining of the ovary. So for the majority of patients, there are exceptions, but for the majority of patients, when we're talking about ovarian cancer, we're actually talking about a cancer that starts on that outer lining of the ovary. But you can also have cancers that arise within the lining of the abdomen called peritoneal cancers. And really, functionally, they're one and the same. We don't differentiate them.
As the ovarian cancer.
That's correct. We differentiate them based on appearance and for statistical reasons. But if you look at them, if you did genetic analyses on these tumors, they're the exact same cancer. We manage them the same. Their response rates are exactly the same.
And how about the fallopian tube?
The fallopian tubes, it's interesting that some recent research is suggesting that many ovarian cancers, particularly those that are in women that are prone to genetic mutations, may actually be starting within the fallopian tube. And that leads to some problems with screening mechanisms, diagnoses, and things that we can get into later today.
The typical ovarian cancer, does it arrive from a single abnormal clone, or can there be multicentric clones?
We think that it's probably multicentric, and that's probably what's led to the difficulty with diagnosis. You see this, what we call a field effect, where when even in somebody that's really early diagnosed, you'll see these little abnormal droplets all over the abdomen and all over the pelvis. It's very, very, very rare to find a small microscopic focus of tumor on an ovary by itself without anything else.
Is that, can you differentiate that from, say, uterine carcinoma? Or cervical carcinoma, would it be more of a single clone going awry?
In cervical cancer, you're probably talking about a single set of cells that starts to multiply and divide and spread from a single focused point. Uterine cancer, probably similar, although not quite as specific. But that's what makes this cancer so difficult, not only to pick up, but also to treat. For example, colon cancers are very localized initially at least to one particular area or polyp. Ovarian cancer and its relative peritoneal cancer by its very nature starts all over the place at once in the majority of cases.
Mm. And it just triggers, when I hear that, I think of endometriosis. Of course, a benign condition, but endometriosis can have foci all over throughout the pelvic and abdominal cavity. Is there any kind of connection at all?
There might be. You know, there was some initial concern that some types of endometriosis might increase the risk for ovarian cancers. We don't exactly know what causes endometriosis either. We know that it's the same tissue that lines the lining of the uterus that for some reason gets outside into the pelvic cavity and starts to grow abnormally, but it's not malignant per se. There are some particular types, clear cell cancers, for example, that can arise within endometriosis, but that's thought to be a little different than your classic ovarian cancer.
Does ovarian cancer, can it be impacted or modulated by hormonal variations?
It can, and that leads us to where we think ovarian cancer might come from. You know, back in the 70s, we used to say, well, maybe it's related to some sort of environmental exposure. There was thought at one time that talc exposure from talcum powder may contribute to it. That was found not to be the case.
Not the case. Okay.
Right, and that's not the case. There was some thought at one point in time that birth control pills might cause it because these cancers do express estrogen and progesterone receptors. However, there's subsequent studies that show that birth control pills actually protect against ovarian cancer. The interesting thing is the men have the same lining to the abdominal cavity as women do, but yet men do not get this cancer. Hmm. So it's clearly something specific to females. There is a open communication that goes from the cervix up through the uterus, out the fallopian tubes, into the abdominal cavity. So it's possible there's some sort of environmental exposure that we just haven't identified yet, but we don't know that for sure. There is definitely a genetic component because patients that have a BRCA mutation, which places them at risk for breast and ovarian cancer, we think that those cancers are starting within the distal, the endmost portion of the fallopian tube. Closer to the ovary. Mm-hmm. We think the cancer actually starts there and drops off onto the ovary mm-hmm. as an abnormal cell and then grows from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you mentioned that having or taking birth controls may have a protective effect against ovarian cancer. Is it the case that also having children or having gone without an ovulation for a period of time is the the factor that may protect against ovarian cancer?
Right. So the classic thinking is that the more ovulatory events you have in your lifetime, the more likely you are to develop ovarian cancer. The initial thought behind that was that damage that was occurring on the outer lining of the ovary with each ovulation and the reparative processes with that contributed to this genetic change that caused cancer. We're not quite certain about that, but we do know that reducing the number of ovulations that you have does reduce your chances of ovarian cancer, whether that be because you're taking birth control pills, which by their action actually keep you from ovulating, or whether that be because of pregnancy, which obviously you're not ovulating because of that. It's interesting, one of the animal models that I studied back when I was a resident and fellow was actually the egg-laying chicken, which ovulates obviously once every couple of weeks. And so once every couple of days. So they can have, you know, by the time they're 4 or 5 years old, their incidence of ovarian cancer is actually 70%.
Mm. Wow. That's interesting. Tell me also, looking further into this, how about patients that have frequent ovarian cysts? Do they imagine they scar over where they have the cyst? Does that impact the frequency of ovarian cancer?
The cysts themselves really are not thought to cause ovarian cancer. Again, there is some association between the cysts and infertility and ovarian cancer, but we can't really figure out what the causative effect is in that area.
And patients who have had ovaries removed, for example, you know, painful ovarian cysts, they're not interested in having more children. Do those patients, once their ovaries removed, have any protective effect?
They do. Matter of fact, for patients with genetic risk for ovarian cancer, we recommend that they have not only their ovaries but also their fallopian tubes removed. For example, a BRCA mutation patient may have a risk of ovarian cancer as high as 60%. If we remove at the age of, say, 35 or 40, her ovaries and her fallopian tubes, we reduce her risk of cancer down to about 5%. Now, notice it's not down to zero.
Right.
And that's because you still can develop these cancers of the lining of the abdomen, but that's still a significant reduction.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and have more when we come back. Call in with your questions, 289-1860 here in Hillsborough County, elsewhere 877-969-8600. We're talking about ovarian cancer with Dr. Tyler Kirby. Be right back.
I don't know about you, but buying a Father's Day gift for the men in my life is a real challenge. They've got enough ties to circle the earth, enough cologne to swim in, and let's face it, most of the time, they just don't need anything. But this year, I found a gift that I know they'll love, an autographed copy of Michael Medved's new book, The 5 Big Lies About American Business. It's a great book that speaks in volumes about the advantages of the free market system that made America great. And like I said, it's personally autographed by Michael Medved himself, so I know it will be appreciated and a cherished possession. Did I forget to tell you, it's just $15. That's right, a personally autographed copy of The 5 Big Lies About American Business delivered to my door, all for just $15. Hey, Father's Day is June 20th, so don't wait. Order a few of these great gifts for the men in your life today. Order by June 11th, and your delivery is guaranteed anywhere in the contiguous United States in time for Father's Day. To order, go to michaelmedved.com. That's michaelmedved.com.
This is Hugh Hewitt in this wild and wacky election year. With the Obama administration stumbling its way through crisis after crisis, where can you go to sort through it all and make sense of what's happening? Hotair.com is a daily destination for all thoughtful conservatives. From the oil disaster in the Gulf, immigration and the economy, Hotair.com will make sure you do not miss a thing. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's indispensable, and it's free. Log on right now and see what you've been missing. Feel the heat at hotair.com.
The following message is brought to you by the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, the Florida broadcasters, and this radio station.
The state of Florida is actively coordinating with federal response agencies and BP on the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. During this time, we encourage everyone to continue to enjoy Florida's beaches while also monitoring advisories on this event. If you have any questions about the oil spill, call the Florida Oil Spill Information Line at 1-888-DEP-3569. That's 1-888-DEP-3569.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, we are back, and we're focusing on ovarian cancer with Dr. Tyler Kirby, who's a gynecologic oncologist. And again, we are focusing on ovarian cancer today. Dr. Kirby does do extensive robotic surgery for gynecologic cancers, and so we welcome questions on that topic as well. So we started talking about ovarian cancer. Where does it come from? Dr. Tyler Kirby discussed how the lesion, the malignancy, can be on the lining of the peritoneum, which is lining inside the body, covering the ovaries, and it also can, this cancer can also come from the fallopian tube. And we talked about how and by the way, Tyler, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, okay?
Sounds good so far.
Okay, and that there's a protective effect, there may be a protective effect against ovarian cancer if there's been some reduction in ovulation frequency, whether it be having pregnant, taking birth control pills. Of course, nothing is complete 100%. We talked on break, and this is an amazing thing. We started talking about how to make the early diagnosis, and the markers, the CA-125. Maybe we should get into that now, talking about the various different markers, the BRCA gene, and I understand there's a new marker, the BNC2.
There's actually quite a number of new markers that they're trying to come out with. And I think you have to take a step back and understand what the purpose of screening tests are first. The idea behind a screening test, in a classic example would be a pap smear, is that you find a pre-malignant lesion that you can remove safely and easily. You have a cheap screening test, and you're going to prevent the cancer from developing further into a more advanced stage. With ovarian cancer, we're not sure that that's the case, because it's not like you're starting with a small 1 centimeter ovarian cyst that you can see on an imaging study that then progresses to an advanced cancer. As a matter of fact, the majority of early stage 1 and 2 ovarian cancers probably never would become an advanced stage cancer until they're very, very late stages. The truly, really bad acting ovarian cancers that are all over the place, they probably start that way in their very earliest stages, so it's hard to find that early lesion.
And sometimes these patients may have minimal symptoms.
Extremely minimal symptoms. You know, they came out with a subset of symptoms that were markers for it, but it's very vague things. It's vague abdominal discomfort. It's irritation of the bladder. It's early fullness after eating. You know, if you looked at this panel of symptoms, I think any one of us would have this kind of stuff from day to day.
And I'm just going to read this from the Ovarian Cancer Research Foundation. These vague symptoms referred to: abdominal bloating, vague but persistent GI or gastrointestinal complaints, change in bowel habits, frequency or urgency of urination, unexplained weight gain or loss, and abnormal vaginal bleeding. How nonspecific can you be?
Yeah, I mean, everybody has some degree of that. So that's led us to look to different blood markers to try to find some indication. And the classic marker has been something called CA-125. Now, they're coming out with additional markers almost on a daily basis nowadays, trying to look for something more specific.
And could you explain what that CA-125 actually is?
The CA-125 is actually It's an antibody to a protein in the blood. And it's called that because it really was almost like his 125th attempt at finding the right marker. But
this protein is synthesized by the ovarian cancer?
It is, but it's also elevated in any kind of inflammatory condition of the lining of the abdomen or the lining of the lungs or the lining of the heart, which leads to it being very nonspecific. You know, things like diverticulitis or pneumonia or endometriosis or pelvic inflammatory disease, endometriosis, all of these other benign conditions can cause it to be elevated. So the problem with any of these screening markers is that, and particularly with CA125, you have to operate on 10 patients with an elevated CA125 to find one cancer. So you're exposing a lot of patients to unnecessary surgery. And even the cancers that you find, 80% of those cancers are already stage 3 or higher.
Which means
they're advanced. And so the question then becomes, anytime you look at a screening test, are you really improving survival? Because you have to take into account the number of patients that may be injured by an unnecessary surgery as well.
So that brings up the need for a better screening test.
We do. We need better screening tests. And unfortunately, some of the more recent screening tests that are being put on the market are really marketed more for monetary reasons and are not necessarily being studied the way they need to be studied.
Tell me about the Ova 1.
Yeah, you need to. The Ova 1 is a new test that just came out. Now, the company is doing the right thing in that they're taking a different approach. There was a similar test that came out about 2 years ago that tried to market it as a screening test. And without any reasonable research, they'd only studied it in like 300 patients.
On the Ova 1 or a different one?
On a different one.
Okay.
This Ova 1 has come out and said, okay, we're not going to use this as a screening test. We're going to use this as a test to try to figure out which patients need to be operated on by a benign gynecologist and which ones need to be operated on by a GYN oncologist. Now, the problem is it's still wrong 50% of the time. So it's not absolute. And for an area like the Tampa Bay market where there really are several very good GYN oncologists in the area, I'm not sure it has that great of a utility. However, if you go to some place like North Dakota or if you go out in the Midwest, some place where it takes 6 hours to get to the nearest GYN oncologist, there's where the real utility is because you can find the patient that needs to be shipped to the major academic center and which patients are fine to be managed at an outpatient community hospital.
Okay. So what you're saying, your recommendation is if you are in an area where there's where it would take a while to get to a gynecologic oncologist to have the test done.
Correct.
And then if it is positive, then go straight to an oncologist.
That's correct. Whereas if and the company says this here, if you're local, if there's any suspicion for it being a potential cancer at all, go ahead and see a GYN oncologist. If it's only a 15-20 minute ride down the road, you know, that's an easy solution.
Let's talk about the use then of the BRCA genes as potential for guiding your recommendations, how to manage these things.
Yeah, genetic mutations that run in families, and one example would be the BRCA or BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation families. They represent about 10% of all ovarian cancers, so it's not a large number. However, if you've got somebody that's got a strong family history, they need to be tested. For example, somebody that has multiple family members with breast or ovarian cancer or a particular family member with an early onset of breast or ovarian cancer. We usually recommend that those patients be tested in their mid-30s or so after they've completed their childbearing. And then if they test positive for one of those mutations, then we recommend counseling with a gynecologic cancer specialist as well as a breast cancer specialist. Most of those patients we are recommending have a prophylactic removal of their ovaries and fallopian tubes to prevent them from developing ovarian cancer, specifically because we do not have a good screening test for those patients.
Okay, so a couple points let's go over. Number one, many people have heard about the BRCA mutation and have heard about it in association with breast cancer. Let's just first make it perfectly clear that there's also an increased risk of ovarian cancer if you're BRCA1 or BRCA2 positive. And I'm just reading here. This is from an article about ovarian cancer, Wall Street Journal, back in August of 2009, which says, Okay. Only about one of every 500 women carries either the BRCA1 or BRCA2. But when they do, they have five times the usual risk of breast cancer and between three and eight times the risk of ovarian cancer.
Yeah, if you look at it from an absolute standpoint, if you live until the age of 80 or 90 years old, your risk of breast cancer with one of those mutations is as high as 70%, and your risk of ovarian cancer with one of those mutations is as high as 60%.
So very highly significant in both cases. But as you pointed out before, they're not sensitive enough. The tests are not sensitive enough.
The screening tests are not sensitive enough. Now, we have for breast cancer, you know, we have great mammograms and now breast MRIs that we can pick up breast cancer in their early stages, and so the cure rates are much better. For ovarian cancer, though, none of the screening tests are good enough, and so that's why we're really recommending prophylactic surgery for those patients.
Okay, so is there any other diagnostic considerations to share with our listeners aside from the mutations? Looking for the mutations in the those patients with positive family history, and the consideration of the CA125. Any other?
There are no screening diagnostic things, but if you do have any of these symptoms, we do recommend that you insist on getting at least an ultrasound and possibly a CAT scan. I have many patients that show up that have been having these symptoms for months, and they tell their doctor, and their doctor blows it off as some sort of GI bug or treats them for a urinary tract infection. Finally, they get an imaging study, and they've got cancer everywhere. So I tell patients, if you're having these symptoms and they're persistent for a month or so, insist on getting at least an ultrasound, if not a CAT scan.
Okay. Are there centers that are more experienced than others to pick up what conceivably be a very, very small early lesion?
I would say a GYN oncologist, a board-certified GYN oncologist anywhere in the country is going to have excellent expertise as far as picking up the earliest stages of this.
Okay, so the GYN oncologist does the ultrasound.
They actually we get the ultrasounds done by a radiologist, for example.
Okay.
But usually I always have patients bring their films in to me to let me look at them, because oftentimes the radiologist will hem and haw or say that there's a benign cyst or it looks like this or that. And I'm able to look at these having the experience of seeing thousands of these ultrasounds and then operating on that same patient. I know what I'm looking for.
Right, right. And now some people may be considering or wondering about any potential radionuclei type of scan or test to try and increase the sensitivity of picking up these lesions. And we had talked about before the show, and your experience with that was not very...
Yeah, we haven't had good experience with that. Some people are looking at the PET scans, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And again, that's another situation where you've got a nonspecific test that may, you know, you may have activity lighting up in the region of an ovary, but do you really know if that's cancer or is it some inflammation and you don't know that?
Let's talk a little bit about ovarian cancer, but we'll do that when we come back on a break. We'll be right back. Again, we encourage you to call in with your questions, 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Everywhere else, it's toll-free, 877-969-8600. We're talking about ovarian cancer with Dr. Tyler Kirby. We'll be right back.
Why does everyone mumble so much?
Restaurants are so noisy.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that, please?
Sound familiar? Dr. Indira Alvarez, board-certified audiologist, can help you hear better today and change your life. I know what you're thinking, but with today's technology, advanced hearing instruments are small and discreet. Don't wait. If you're having hearing difficulties, call Alvarez Audiology for an appointment. 813-265-2255. That's 813-265-2255.
This is Hugh Hewitt in this wild and wacky election year. With the Obama administration stumbling its way through crisis after crisis, where can you go to sort through it all and make sense of what's happening? HotAir.com is a daily destination for all thoughtful conservatives. From the oil disaster in the Gulf, immigration, and the economy, HotAir.com will make sure you do not miss a thing. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's indispensable, and it's free. Log on right now and see what you've been missing. Feel the heat at HotAir.com.
This is the Prescription Addiction Radio Show.
Commissioner Susan Latvala.
It's time the silence was broken. This is a terrible, terrible blight on our society. Because the medicine came from a doctor, and then it's too late, and they're addicted. And when you see children dying as well as adults, it's time we all woke up and paid attention and then do what we have to do to stop it.
The Prescription Addiction Radio Show. Sunday nights at 9 on Talk Radio 860. WGUL.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin. Focus on
Females. Okay, welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. I'm with Dr. Tyler Kirby, gynecologic oncologist, and we are talking about ovarian cancer. And a couple of little facts I'd like to share with you. Again, this is from that same article I referenced before. An estimated 21,000 women in the United States were diagnosed with ovarian cancer in 2008, and more than 15,000 died from it, which underscores the point you're making about how difficult it can be to detect this cancer.
It can be. It's, as I said, about 80% of these cancers are going to be in what we call stage 3 or stage 4, which is very advanced cancer. Now, fortunately, we've been much more successful recently at maybe not curing them, but at least prolonging their survival in a good quality way. There have been new chemotherapy drugs and new ways of treating this, particularly surgically, that have really improved response rates and really almost turned some of these patients into more of a chronic disease that you can live with as opposed to something that you're definitely going to die from.
Well, that's quite significant. Let's talk a little bit about that. So let me just throw out the general question. How is ovarian cancer treated?
Well, the typical way is with a very aggressive upfront surgical procedure. The goal is to remove as much of the cancer as possible. Now, we used to say about 10 years ago that if we could get all of the cancer down to less than 1 centimeter of residual cancer, then they had a good response. There have been some more recent studies out of Memorial Sloan Kettering and out of Johns Hopkins, and it's really disseminating out into all of the GYN oncologists, that if we really get very radical in removing as much of this as possible down to where you can't even see any left behind, then we can even double their survival even longer after that. So we've expanded our techniques. We used to, if we had disease up along the liver, along the diaphragm and the spleen, upper abdomen, stomach area, we used to leave that disease behind and say that that patient was not going to be resectable. Now we go in there and we strip off this tumor off of the liver, we strip it off of the diaphragm, we take out the spleen, we take out part of the pancreas, part of the stomach. We're really getting a lot more aggressive at doing these things. And as a result, we're taking average survivals, what used to be in the 4 to 5 year range, and in some cases, if we get them down to no residual disease, we're pushing their average survivals out to 9-10 years.
Wow, wow. The surgery itself, is it always done in one setting, in one visit to the operating room? It sounds like it could be fairly lengthy.
It is. Most of these surgeries take anywhere from 4 to 5 hours to perform. I tell my patients you can expect to be in an intensive care setting and probably you're going to spend a good week to 2 weeks in the hospital after this. Mm-hmm. But it's worth it in the end, because if you take somebody that has bulky residual cancer versus no residual cancer, the patient that has no residual cancer, their survival is twice that of the patient with bulky cancer.
Mm-hmm. And you use like a chemotherapeutic wash after you finish in case there are any residual cells?
There's some research ongoing in looking at intraoperative use of intraperitoneal chemotherapy. One term for that is called HIPEC, that's H-I-P-E-C. That's still in the early research phases right now. It has some significant toxicity. What we are doing is once we get the patient recovered from the surgery, then we treat them with chemotherapy into the abdominal cavity called intraperitoneal chemotherapy. That's been shown to significantly improve survival, about 20% improvement in survival, and about an average year and a half prolongation in average survival if we do that.
And that's done as an outpatient?
It is. We used to do it as an inpatient, but now we're starting to do most of them as an outpatient. The problems with that treatment is that past studies have shown it to be very toxic. There were some studies that only about 50% of patients were able to complete the study protocol. And so we've modified that treatment somewhat. And in our practice, I would say easily 90% of our patients finish the full 4 or 5 months of treatment without really any major problems.
And how frequently does one undergo? Is it a weekly thing or more frequently?
It depends. There's currently, and we have this study at our practice as well, a National Cancer Institute study comparing different treatment regimens and schedules. The older classic regimen was you would do it on, for example, a Monday and then a Tuesday and then the following Monday, and then you take a week off and then you come back and do that again. But we're starting to look at maybe once a week regimens, once every 3 week regimens. We think the more frequent the chemotherapy is given, then the better the response rate.
Is there a way to monitor the progress? We talked about the dissatisfaction in the sensitivity of some of these the markers or the false positives in the case of some of these markers. Is there any way to monitor the progress in patients that are under treatment?
Yeah. So 70% of ovarian cancer patients will have an elevation in their Ca-125. For those other 30%, there's another marker called HE4. When you combine those two markers, you cover about 90% of ovarian cancers. Although the cancer markers are not very good in a screening setting, once you know someone has a cancer, then you can follow those markers, and they're very accurate in following their response to treatment as well as potential recurrences down the road.
Okay, excellent. Do you ever get into a situation where there's a suggestion that there may be a recurrence, and then the challenge is finding out where it is?
It's very common. Matter of fact, especially if we're following these markers. There's two philosophies of thought around the world. One philosophy says if they're not symptomatic from it, don't bother looking. I personally don't.
Despite the fact that the numbers are going up?
Despite the fact that the numbers are going up, there's some studies that show that survival with earlier treatment may not necessarily be any better than waiting until they're symptomatic. My personal preference is if I see a marker rising, I start looking very carefully because it may be something that I can just go in and surgically remove fairly easily. So we look at markers, we look at CAT scans, but there's the new technology we mentioned, the PET scan, where they give you a radioactive form of glucose that's taken up preferentially by cancer cells, and you can identify lesions that may be missed on other studies.
Okay. So that's where the PET scan may have a purpose here in ovarian cancer.
Exactly.
Not so much identifying whether or not a person has it to begin with, but once you know they have it, to follow the disease may be useful.
It's very useful to particularly identify an elevation in a tumor marker that you can't find another explanation for. Or, for example, you do a CAT scan with somebody that has normal markers and you can't decide if something really is cancerous or is it just some benign lesion. PET scans are very useful at identifying that.
I want to make another point. Earlier we talked about ultrasound. Are we talking for diagnosis? Are we talking about the transvaginal ultrasound?
You really need a transvaginal ultrasound to see the ovaries well. If you're looking transabdominally, you can't see the ovaries very easily. And even if you do see them, you can't really identify some of the subtle indications of possible cancer that we're looking at. For example, within a cystic mass, we're looking at small little papillations or outgrowths from the wall of the cyst. Those kind of things are hard to pick up on a transabdominal scan.
So I'm going to go back to the point we were making before about the identifying in a patient who has known ovarian cancer, is post-surgery, is post-chemotherapy, the markers have gone up. Whether or not the patient's symptomatic or not, you're concerned, you want to do something for them, you do a PET scan. What if the PET scan does not help you or guide you? And how frequently does that happen? How do you know where to look inside the abdomen or pelvis?
Most of the ovarian cancers, when they recur, are going to recur within the abdominal cavity themselves. You can get some lymph node recurrences occasionally some lung recurrences, but for the most part, the rest of the body is fairly spared. So if a PET scan is negative, even if their marker is rising slowly, most of the time I'll just watch that patient and repeat their marker over time. Sometimes I'll give them a hormonal therapy with the attempt to try to slow its growth.
Okay.
But you have to remember that you've got a patient that really is, they're functional. They don't have any symptoms from their cancer. And if you can't find it radiographically anyway, a marker, a blood marker by itself is really not going to change what you do.
So those patients will be followed that much more closely, I imagine.
Yeah, I usually increase the frequency of their scans, increase the frequency of clinical exams and blood tests on this.
Okay, all right, very good. Let's talk about any new treatments on the horizon that maybe are not available today, but maybe in the next 3 years.
Yeah, some of the most amazing research that's been coming out the last 5 years has to do with altering the cancer cells' access to new blood vessels. We call it anti-angiogenesis therapy. The classic example of that is something called Avastin. That's A-V-A-S-T-I-N. That's been amazingly successful for all sorts of cancers. Right now, it's approved for colon cancer, breast cancer, and lung cancer. Now, ovarian cancer, it's not FDA approved. That mainly has to do with the lack of the number of ovarian cancer patients we have to get a study that shows significance. Now, the studies that we have been able to complete have shown remarkable success, both in a frontline setting as well as in a second or third or even fifth line setting. So we're really starting to try to push to use that. The downside and the reason most of the insurance companies and particularly Medicare have been not wanting to pay for it is it's extremely expensive. You're talking about some anywhere from $5,000 to $12,000 per month.
Wow. Yeah. Well, steering away from the cost issue, obviously that's a whole other area of concern, the cost of pharmaceuticals. But it is showing, and we should again emphasize that thus far the results in studies are positive as far as the efficacy of this drug.
That's correct. There was a study that was just completed that's going to be presented next month at ASCO, which is the National American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, looking at Avastin plus traditional chemotherapy up front in stage 3 and 4 cancer patients that did show improvement in survival over traditional chemotherapy. But you had to give the Avastin not only for the first 4 or 5 months of chemotherapy, but an additional 1 year of Avastin after that. So you're talking about almost a year and a half of Avastin therapy to get that benefit. Now, the study's not out yet, so I can't tell you any specific numbers other than it was definitely significant. And it was significant enough so that the National Cancer Institute implemented Avastin for use in everyone in their most recent protocol that just opened about 4 months ago.
Okay. All right, so now the Avastin is not intraperitoneal like the other chemotherapy as you mentioned.
No,
before.
It's in the IV just like regular chemotherapy is.
And in the protocols for ovarian cancer, how frequently does the patient get that IV?
Right now, if you're in a research protocol, specifically this National Cancer Institute protocol called GOG-252, every arm of that protocol gets the Avastin. Unfortunately, for people that are not in that research protocol, the majority of patients are not getting Avastin because it's not approved by any insurance or Medicare.
The ones in the protocol, how frequently do they receive the Avastin?
They get it every 3 weeks in the IV. Okay. Now, the nice thing about these new drugs is that they don't cause the same side effects as traditional chemotherapy. Now, you'll have the side effects from the combined chemotherapy with it, but you're not adding to that. You don't get the hair loss or the bone marrow toxicity or anything like that. The unusual thing about Avastin, however, is that for about 5% of patients, they can really have some major toxicities, and that's been one of the concerns.
Could you make a comment? We're going to turn a little bit our attention now to hormone therapy and ovarian cancer. Is there considered, for those patients that are on hormone replacement therapy, is there an increased risk to develop ovarian cancer?
That's been one of those really hard things to figure out. Particularly for ovarian cancer. It's hard enough in breast cancer where there's some, 400,000 cases a year. In ovarian cancer with only 20,000 per year, it's really, really difficult. We don't think that it causes ovarian cancer. It potentially could make a cancer that's already there grow a little more just because these cancers do have estrogen receptors. But I certainly would not withhold hormone therapies for someone because of that potential risk.
What if a patient was BRCA positive?
Well, the reason that those hormones are withheld in those patients has to do more with their breast cancer risk, not their ovarian cancer risk.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, there are some doctors around the country that once we remove the ovaries and fallopian tubes, and also sometimes the patients will have a prophylactic mastectomy, removal of the breast, then we'll go back and give that patient estrogen for quality of life, feeling fairly comfortable that we've reduced their risk.
Okay. All right. We have only a few minutes left. Let me start this way. And again, now is the time to call in with a question if you have a question. But Tyler, would you please summarize or identify maybe one or two talking points that you'd like to leave our listeners with about ovarian cancer?
I think the key thing is be your own advocate. If you think something's wrong with your body, seek out the best advice you can and make sure that somebody doesn't blow you off. Secondly, if you have a cancer, go to the person that specializes in that cancer. Don't just assume that because your doctor says that they can do it, that they're very good at it. Go to the GYN oncologist, go to the specialist, get the right surgery up front. If you delay and you don't have that surgery up front, your survival is going to be less.
Dr. Kirby's two points are excellent, and we can, here at Focus on Females, of course, we broaden that across the board. Everywhere in medicine, you've got to be your own advocate. It's hard to find credible, reliable information now more than ever. You go to the internet and you try to do some research. Some of it may be accurate, some not. So you need to be your own advocate for yourself. And again, you do need to identify where to get that information. That, for example, there is such a thing as a gynecologic oncologist. You need to identify who is best suited to take care of the problem, the medical problem that you have or a loved one has. Critically important information. Okay, I'd like to thank Dr. Tyler Kirby. And, Dr. Kirby, would you like to share your contact information? We have 1 minute as far as in case listeners have a question that I'd like to follow up with you.
Yeah, you can contact me or my partner, Hector Arango. We're with West Coast Gynecologic Oncology. The phone number is 727-446-2111. We're also on the internet at westcoastgynecologiconcology.com. And also, if you're not in the area, I encourage you to visit the Women's Cancer Network, WCN.org. That's an excellent source for all sorts of female cancers.
Excellent. And on this closing on this topic, I'd like to read a quote again from that article that I had referenced earlier. If a woman has symptoms that are recent, persistent, and otherwise unexplained, she should go to her provider and say, quote, prove to me I don't have ovarian cancer.
That's an excellent advice.
Okay, and next week on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, we're going to tackle coagulation with hemophilia and von Willebrand's disease. Hemophilia and von Willebrand's disease, the following week tuberculosis, followed by sexually transmitted diseases, followed by blepharitis, then diverticulosis and diverticulitis, followed by pelvic organ prolapse, dry eye and meibomian gland disease, and put your hemorrhoids behind you. That takes us into August, and for us, this is Dr. Steve Maskin, and I'd like to wish each and every one of you a healthy and happy week, and we'll see you next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Bye-bye.
Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
Certain dates in American history have defined who we are as a nation. July 4th, 1776. December 7th, 1941. September 11th, 2001. Today is one of those days, a day for better or worse, that shaped America, whether you realize it or not. June 6th, 1944.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, the eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
We create national holidays to celebrate or to remember. And as is usually the case with each new generation, the significance of those dates fades.
I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of